Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, which is a podcast part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Kimberly Chong, who's a lecturer in anthropology at the University College London, about her new book, Best Practice, Management Consulting and the Ethics of Financialization in China, which is published by Duke University Press. So welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Dave. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
It's great to have you on, and it's great to be talking about this brilliant and really interesting book that is both, I guess, a very global, you know, kind of big picture book that tells the story of management consulting, financialization, but also is a story about contemporary China as well. There was just so much kind of fascinating stuff in there. The way to probably kind of introduce the book is, I guess, to kind of give us a sense of why you're interested in writing the book, both in terms of kind of these broad theories of financialization, the specifics of kind of management consultancy, and then why these themes in China?
Sure. So most large organizations, whether they're multinational corporations or big public sector organizations, will have hired management consultants at some point. Management consultants play a very important role in determining kind of prevailing work practices, lived experiences of labour, and also the kinds of business models and economic forms that we see in the global economy. In short, they have a huge amount of power and influence. At the same time, their expertise is very much subject to question. It's not easy to ascertain if the kinds of prescriptions that management consultants give to their clients actually have their desired effects. You know, do they work? Do consultants actually make things better? And yet, despite these question marks over their expertise, you know, they continue to flourish. Consultancy, the consulting industries is growing very rapidly. So it was these two aspects that really kind of grasped my interest. You know, the fact that management consultants have a growing influence in shaping global economic forms. At the same time, they have a kind of shaky expertise. This kind of was a starting point for my investigation.
I think it was really interesting early on in the book. You've got this line, I think it's something like, you know, you wanted to know what management consultants do and how they do it. And it sort of struck me that, you know, for an industry that is both incredibly economically important, but also is like clearly, you know, sort of transforming the social in a variety of different ways, it'd be kind of strange if we were kind of like, well, what do doctors do?
Yeah.
How do they do it? Although that's obviously been like a tradition in bits of anthropology and sociology. I guess the sort of like the setting for those questions really matters as well. And you worked with particular organization, which you call Sisteo in the book.
Yep, that's right.
And you worked with them in China, although they're a global player with lots of different bits and offices across the globe. And it'd be good to get a sense of that kind of like what they do and how they do it in the Chinese context and in the context of Sisteo as well.
So as you say, Sisteo is a pseudonym for this global management consultancy, which I managed to gain access to. They're already established in Europe and North America. And at the time of my fieldwork, they were starting to set up operations in China. in the early noughties. So I did my fieldwork from 2007 to 2009, but they had already set up just before then. So this was very much the second phase of Deng Xiaoping's market reforms. China, as sort of everyone knows, has turned away from a socialist command economy towards one that is based on market principles. And this became, you know, much more pronounced from the 1990s. And something that's very important for the management consulting industry was the fact that state-owned enterprises were either privatized or corporatized. And so the ones that are corporatized were then floated on stock exchanges. Now, these corporatized SOEs or state-owned enterprises sought the services of Western management consultancies, global management consultancies, including Sisteo, to help them prepare for their stock market flotation. And the kind of consultancy that Sisteo does was very much critical to them being asked to help out in this process. So most people will have heard of kind of strategy consultants, you know, the likes of McKinsey. However, the largest management consultancies, both in terms of headcount and profit, are ones which sell consulting solutions that involve IT in some kind of way. So selling IT management systems or IT-enabled outsourcing. And this is exactly what Sisteo does. So it would sell IT systems, in particular, one called ERP systems, enterprise resource planning systems, to state-owned enterprises. And these were kinds of representations of modern management to assuage investors that the concerns of investors who might be worried that, you know, SOEs are not operating according to global norms. You know, by installing modern management IT systems, you sort of say, well, actually, they're just like other big blue chip companies that you've heard of. They're not sort of some kind of socialist, employment center or something. You know, they're actually operating to the norms of global capitalism that you and I all know very well. So that's really why Western consultancies were brought into these Chinese firms, and that was very lucrative for Sisteo and other similar consultancies.
I mean, it's so interesting, that point, actually. The kind of, it's not even attention, is it? It's the question of how these standard models get adapted around the world, and what that tells us both about the standard model and how, you know, secretly it's kind of quite flexible. But also what it tells us about the context in which those models are sort of placed into. And I guess the final kind of bit of ground clearing is maybe a kind of theory question. That there's, you know, you talk about financialization in the title of the book, but also commensuration is really important throughout the book. And those two terms, it'd be good to hear a kind of definition or, you know, a little sort of explanation of what they are, because I think crucially they explain actually how these kind of standard practices, like, you know, mm-hmm. IT systems or preparations for being sold or, you know, opened up to an IPO or whatever, have a particular kind of manifestation when they're in China.
Yeah, so in the book I document how the expansion of management consulting went hand in hand with the rise of financialization. So, you know, financialization has various definitions. You know, some people say it's, you know, the increased importance of financial markets, the increasing importance of finance for non-financial entities. You know, other people have highlighted the importance of shareholder value ideology, you know, the fact that companies are, you know, see their sole mission as being creating value for their shareholders at the expense of other stakeholders. Now, the approach I take in this book is to say, well, you know, seeing financialization as these different definitions is kind of a red herring. What joins or encompasses these different definitions is how different regimes of worth have been established or brought into play. You know, how have they sought to elevate the production of certain registers of value, like financial value? And the title of my book, Best Practice, highlights this. It highlights the fact that consultants are in the business of creating an ethical remit for their interventions. So no set of practices are self-evidently best or good. Rather, their designation as best has to be created and worked on. So, you know, to say, oh, we should pursue shareholder value and that is best practice, you know, what do we have to do in order to make that claim and substantiate that claim? So what I argue is that management consultants are in the business of naturalizing or legitimating certain regimes of worth through which different registers of value are brought into equivalence. In other words, they work to commensurate different values. You know, so these could be financial value and social values, cultural values. And so I'm asking, you know, certain questions. You know, how do consultants instantiate new regimes of worth into their clients' organizations? You know, what techniques and what kinds of devices do they draw on to instantiate these kinds of these regimes of worth? And these questions really highlight the importance of commensuration for performing consultants' expertise.
I mean, one really great example, I think it's maybe in the second chapter of the book or maybe the third, of precisely one of those devices is the idea of the billable hour. And this word that I was really into, this billability, as a kind of mode of measurement, performance management tool, but also something that was basically kind of necessary for the functioning of the company. You know, without it, it was almost kind of impossible to see how the company could function. And I wonder actually whether that could be used as an example to kind of talk about commensuration in practice through what seems to be sort of like, you know, quite a complicated and highly gameable system of measurement.
Yeah, so performance management was it's something that is it is ubiquitous. You know, most of us will have come into contact with performance management, whether in our own employment or, you know, we know other people who are managed via performance management, and in many ways, you know, people know that it's highly problematic. But it, you know, continues to prevail. And management consultants, you know, they not only practice it in-house, you know, they're also responsible for propagating performance management. You know, a lot of what they do is to sell performance management as a management solution. And I found performance management just fascinating. It was a place where you could find commensuration happening in all different kinds of ways. It's really integral to things like rating and ranking employees, which you see in many different kinds of organizations. And you know, this idea that, you know, you can judge an employee's performance by objectives that they set themselves, you know, that sounds great. But you know, in practice, it's actually very difficult to compare the performances of different employees. You know, to do that, you need to narrow down the range of criteria, which in itself is a moral and political choice about what are the suitable criteria, which can be used to measure performance. So in the case of consultants, one criteria which was very important and which I talk about, which you've just mentioned, is billable hours, billability. And so, you know, billability referred to the number of hours or the percentage of their work time which they could bill to a client. And I talk about how this is used as a proxy for consultants' revenue generating capabilities, which in turn is used as an index for their performance. And you know, the kind of questions that I pose is, you know, well, you know, what that suggests that these are, first of all, that, you know, billability is completely within a consultant's control, when actually I show that that's not always the case. You know, if the consultancy isn't doing very well, there might not be any projects, there might not be any clients who want to, you know, hire Sisteo, and you know, you might have a low billable score for that. And yet it's internalized through these systems as a quality of individual merit. And I show the sort of various ways in which this is done, how different registers of value are made commensurate in order to kind of produce these discursive effects.
I mean, at the same time, I suppose like a lot of us think, you know, pay is wages, salary is a way of doing commensuration of making, you know, kind of rankings or judgments about people. But at the same time as this system of billability is crucial to Steyo in China and, you know, its broader operations, you show in that second chapter that like talking about money was a big no-no. and I was really struck by the story you tell, I think it's at the start of that chapter, about how discussions about pay were really off the table, you know, and were really kind of inappropriate. And in some ways were framed as actually a problem about how management consultancy was going to, you know, struggle in China because precisely people were, you know, asking about salaries, which was sort of a strange kind of position to be in.
Yeah, so because management consulting is primarily an ethical project, you know, it's creating ethical remits for change within an organization, the prevailing norms or ethics of everyday operation are very important. Now, when it became apparent that some of the most taken for granted norms, such as the salary taboo, were not found in China, this had, you know, this had really big implications for the potential success of management consulting in this context. So, you know, it's worth just sort of talking a little bit about the salary taboo. So, you know, in the UK and in the US certainly, you know, it's considered to be taboo to tell people or to ask someone how much they earn. And, you know, one of the reasons why that is because personal worth is quite closely tied to financial worth in these places. However, in China, there are different indexes of individual worth, such as, you know, what I talk about, which is the Chinese concept of suzhi, a term which is usually glossed as human quality. And suzhi is a value which cannot be reduced to economic or market value. In that sense, it's a form of status that is irreducible to money or income. And because there is this looser connection between personal worth and economic worth, speaking openly about money is less problematic in China. Now, what are the implications for performance management? So what I show is that performance management actually needs this salary taboo. It needs employees to not talk to each other about how much they earn. What we're told in performance management is that what you are paid is supposed to be tied to your performance, tied to merit. However, we all know that there are other reasons why someone might be paid more or less than you. You know, we know there are gender gaps when it comes to pay. There are other forms of discrimination at play as well. In order, though, for performance management to be seen only as a meritocratic system, you need to ensure that people are not asking each other how much they are paid, and to therefore keep this, you know, hidden assumption that actually performance is really what's driving pay differentials within an organization. So what happened was when, you know, as soon as, you know, pay rises or bonuses came out, the Chinese consultants would instantly start sharing this information. And those who didn't get as big a rise or bonus as the others would go to their managers and ask for a rise. And this kind of threatened the performance management system, and more importantly, threatened their expertise, because then how were they going to sell the system onto their clients if they weren't behaving appropriately, them, you know, within their own management systems?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
There's lots and lots of things to pick up on there. And you've actually, you know, kind of laid out many of the themes that come up later in the book. I'll pick up on one in particular, which is like literally the last thing you just said, which was this idea about kind of selling consultancy. And I guess that takes us back to the question of like, what do management consultants do? Mm-hmm. How do they do it? So how were they kind of trained to sell consultancy? You know, like you've got this example of a short film that has, you know, a really kind of like strong social or ethical impact, mm-hmm. but it's also like absolutely appalling at the same time. And that was a way of kind of almost like mystifying what it is to sell this kind of, on the one hand, quite unclear object, but also this set of, you know, quite rigid quasi-scientific techniques. So yeah, how are they trained to sell and what is it that they're selling?
Really good questions. So it's important to remember that consultants aren't always hired for tangible results. You know, clients can call in consultants because of, you know, internal politics, you know, that warrant an outsourcing of decision making. So it's not because A wants it or B wants it. It's because the management consultants say it's the best course of action. So how then do consultants make this case? So what I show is that, you know, consultants are taught the importance of narrative, you know, to make the moral and political imperative for their interventions. And this is important because, you know, the knowledge that they sell is, well, one, it's often borrowed from other sources. You know, management consultants rarely produce proprietary knowledge. But also the character of the knowledge they sell, you know, I talk about how, you know, consultants are selling performative, you know, knowledge, performative business models. That is to say, they're in the business of creating new economic realities through which they then hope to substantiate their claim to expertise, if that makes sense. And so one of the ways that they learn how to do this is by trying to find or perform rather a scientific basis for the knowledge, for the expertise that they are selling. So in the chapter that you're referring to, I talk about the different kinds of devices through which they are taught to, you know, believe in their own capacities to control sort of inherently uncertain and unpredictable aspects of organizations and client relations. So I talk about the deal power maps, also the trust equation. You know, consultants learn the importance of developing client relations, and that this moreover has a scientific foundation. So, you know, trust can be modeled through the trust equation. And these ways of talking about social relations have particular subjectifying effects. It helps consultants to really believe in the potency of their expertise, which is very, you know, it's especially necessary when you don't have proprietary knowledge, when you know there is a kind of unverifiability to your expertise.
I mean, if there is this, I keep saying tension, but in some ways, you know, it's not actually a tension because it's productive. But if there is this sense of, you know, the sort of the mystical and the scientific at the same time, and the, you know, training in how to be able to speak these languages and roll out these techniques with promises of, as you've mentioned, you know, financial performance, mm-hmm. but also things like you will just, you know, the company will be better, you know, this sort of thing. What was it like to kind of to live as these one of these people, to, you know, to kind of be these management consultants? Later on in the book, you've got this example of Global Co, mm-hmm. Which you use, I guess, as almost a kind of an ethnography of like what life is like for the impression I got, at least, was, you know, a member of the Chinese middle class.
Yeah. So it's what I found fascinating when I was doing my fieldwork was that probably more so than expatriate consultants, Chinese consultants were really quite aware of the contradictions of management consulting. And I actually think this was quite helpful for them in terms of their, you know, managing their clients and their and a sort of lived experience of consulting. You know, I was always impressed by the remarkable sensitivity and emotional intelligence of the consultants, of the Chinese consultants, who, you know, they seem to be able to read their clients incredibly well and react very, very nimbly to their demands. And in the ethnography of Global Co, this client, this sort of multinational corporation that I call Global Co, I talk about how, you know, although there's this emphasis on kind of, you know, skill sets and, you know, consultants' technical capabilities, you know, that kind of narration seems to miss the heart of consulting, which is actually client relations. And I think that the Chinese consultants did very well at managing client relations. But there was this, you know, they were really being pulled sort of in different directions all the time. You know, the clients were always making demands on them, and they were expected to almost kind of, you know, disappear into the or melt into the client's organization. And, you know, I talk about how there's a sort of a liminal experience of being a management consultant. On the one hand, you know, they are, you know, they are Sisteo consultants and they're supposed to be, you know, ambassadors for the company. On the other hand, they spend the majority of their time inside their clients' organizations. And in order to, you know, foster good client relations, you know, they have to, you know, almost be kind of seamless with their clients. And some of them, you know, they even have, you know, their clients' email addresses, you know, they have an email address of their client's organization rather, and they need to behave in a way that is acceptable to their clients. And so this sort of leads to this in-betweenness, you know, they have to at once fulfill the kind of professional protocols of being a Sisteo management consultant. At the same time, they need to fulfill, you know, or at least, you know, resonate or embody the norms and values of their clients, and I think this is actually quite difficult and quite a stressful thing to do. But I think the consultants did it very well, especially those who had been there for a while, and they had learnt that this was really what it meant to be a good management consultant.
I mean, there's other examples in the book of particular kinds of labor and laboring spaces that speak more directly to the kind of global nature of management consultants as a sort of economic practice. But I wonder if we might talk a little bit more about that, not certain tensions, but, you know, that kind of like balancing of the Chinese context. And right towards the end of the book, you sort of drill down into Something that is a fairly sort of standard idea in many of our like discussions of contemporary business, which is corporate social responsibility. But that, you know, kind of everyday lived reality that you've just described manifests itself sort of differently in the Chinese context when it comes to CSR, with like placements, social impact schemes. You might actually, the story of the charity bike ride was really interesting. Mm-hmm. And what struck me about that chapter was not so much the kind of, you know, CSR story, but how, I want to be delicate here, but how many of the employees were seen as a kind of problem that needs to be quote unquote civilized into the demands of a global management company. And it'd be great to hear both the kind of the story of CSR, you know, perhaps through these social schemes, but also that underlying, civilizing project, which I must admit I found kind of like highly problematic.
Yeah, so I wouldn't be the first, academic who study management consultants to say that, you know, that management consultants rather are, in the business of selling professionalism or embodying professionalism. And if you I would agree with that view, but I also, you know, I have a lot more to add. You know, I also talk about, you know, as I already said, you know, the importance of an ethical remit and creating that ethical projects. But if you see professionalism as being integral to being a management consultant, you can start to understand why having the right kind of subjectivity is so important for Sisteo. And so, you know, they come to China, they set up office in China, and although, you know, China's already, you know, market reforms have already, you know, they've already been going for quite a while, they're in full swing, many of the things that they take for granted about market-oriented practice, you know, capitalist norms simply aren't there. And yet, you know, there's an assumption that this is these are universal, this is a kind of, a universal way of operating. And so a lot of the differences that expatriate consultants encountered when in China was often posed as a difference, you know, a cultural difference, which I found always highly problematic, and, you know, a very simplistic answer for explaining why certain initiatives wouldn't work. But nevertheless, it was interesting that this, you know, assumed cultural difference then led to an assumption and practices that, you know, that we should then try to, you know, improve the subjectivities of Chinese consultants, you know, as you say, sort of this idea of sort of civilizing them somehow to the needs of a global management consultancy. And one of the ways which they did this was through CSR, through corporate social responsibility. Now, CSR was in its infancy in the China offices. It was very well established in Sisteo's Europe and North America offices, and it was seen as a very important way of nourishing employee engagement. So, you know, as I just described in earlier chapters, employee engagement has sort of two alternative narrations. On the one hand, it's seen as a way of, you know, improving employee motivation and commitment to the firm. At the same time, it's measured through total shareholder return. In other words, employees are also seen as a financial assets. So what was interesting in this context was that what I was observing was a kind of an example of internal CSR. CSR is often associated with companies that, you know, clearly produce harmful effects. So, you know, tobacco companies, oil companies. And so those kind of companies, you know, they're very concerned about the kind of reputational benefits that CSR might confer. You know, management consultancies, by contrast, can seem, you know, they seem pretty benign. But in fact, management consultancies can be quite destructive. You know, they can wreak harm through, you know, restructuring, you know, IT systems that don't work. You know, they divert funds which have been earmarked for other purposes. You know, the NHS spends millions of pounds on consultants, for example. So there is this question of, you know, do management consultants, you know, do the interventions work? You know, is it fraud? And therefore, there's clearly a need to conspicuously ethicise their work and the company's reputation. And this was also, this was important, not just externally, but also internally. You know, consultants, you know, they are very aware that there are question marks over their expertise and about what they're doing to other organisations. And there is this need to fill this kind of moral and social vacuum. So what I argue is that CSR is vital to this. And I describe a particular CSR initiative, this charity bike ride, which takes place in Sichuan in the aftermath of the terrible earthquake that happened there. And, you know, what was very interesting was, you know, I joined the consultants in cycling across Sichuan, and, you know, I was able to get a lot of, you know, have a lot of conversations with them about what exactly they were doing and what they thought, you know, what they thought this bike ride was achieving. And, you know, what I found was that actually, you know, there are particular assumptions that underpin CSR. You know, you find that CSR tries to fill in the gaps of the state. You know, it happens when the state is usually absent. So, you know, it's the idea that, like, you know, if we didn't come here, then these children wouldn't have a school. You know, we're here to help rebuild their school that got, you know, that fell down during the earthquake. Now, that kind of ethical impetus doesn't really have traction if the consultants say, yes, but even if we didn't come here, wouldn't the state have rebuilt it anyway, right? So in other words, CSR doesn't quite work. It doesn't have the same ethical effects when there is a strong state like you find in China. And because it doesn't have the same kind of ethical effects, it also doesn't have the same subjectifying effects that is desired as an internal kind of management practice, if that makes sense.
I mean, it's so fascinating because all the way through the book is that, you know, kind of question of almost what will win. Will, you know, the practices of commensurization and the associated kind of, you know, little financialized subjects that it might produce, how will it be adapted to the Chinese context? And I mean, what will win is not an appropriate question, you know, to ask, you know, both a kind of fascinating bit of anthropology, but also a really rich anthropological study. But yeah, what will win? You know, will we see maybe the kind of re-exporting of a particular Chinese mode of commensuration back to the States, back to Britain, you know, those kind of consultants? Or, you know, will it be a case of China's state doing what it's done seemingly for a long time now and just, you know, kind of adapting the bits that work? And, you know, kind of dumping the bits that don't, you know, a strong social norm around like not asking for wages. Well, that's not going to work here. But actually, you know, the techniques of billability, you know, they can be applied. You know, that kind of like outward, we've rebuilt your school. You should be, you know, proud of us as, I don't know, a monstrous oil company isn't going to work. But, you know, the kind of the sense of, we have a different relationship with our corporate entity and our corporate identity because we've been involved in this project. What do you think?
Well, I would say that, you know, possibly, I mean, not possibly, probably, that, you know, that these questions and the approach that I've taken reflects, you know, reflects methodology, reflects the terms of access, you know. In the sense that, you know, one of the reasons why Sestero let me in was because they were You know, they were very puzzled by these differential responses, both from their own consultants, but also from Chinese clients. And, you know, rather than taking that at face value, I took that as a kind of rupture through which, you know, I would be able to explore the different kinds of epistemologies and also, you know, techniques and practices that are, you know, really the foundation of management consulting. I think really a lot of the problem stems from the fact that what management consultants do is they really try to suggest that there's a kind of, you know, there's this universalizing tendency in terms of the narration of their interventions, that this, you know, this is the, you know, a best practice, and that there is this, you know, this, there's a undefiable kind of basis to these claims. And what I show in the ethnography is how, you know, this veil is kind of pulled back by the Chinese consultants, who are constantly revealing how historically and locally situated these claims really are. And that when you try to then export models which are historically and locally situated in a financialized Western context to state capitalist China, you undoubtedly are going to come across particular challenges or hurdles in the process. And in a way, this isn't surprising. Perhaps what is more surprising is assuming that these models could be seamlessly replicated all over the world. And yes, of course, China has its own, you know, very, very specific kind of nature of its economy. You know, a strong state, this kind of state capitalist form. But at the same time, that there are aspects of the Chinese economy which you can find elsewhere as well. I mean, China is not the only place with a strong state. And I would say that, you know, that there were aspects of, you know, orientalization of difference that were clearly present, you know, and are kind of, you know, revealed in the ethnography as well, that, you know, I sort of questioned to what extent, you know, is China so different? But at the same time, I suggest that when difference is highlighted by Chinese consultants, you know, it's more that they are revealing that certain assumptions are quite specific to the origination of these business models or management systems, and that we need that, you know, that doesn't mean that they can't be used in China, but perhaps different systems of meaning have to be drawn on in order to make them intelligible to Chinese clients.
There's so much more we could discuss, actually, even in that answer about, you know, the reconfiguration of these practices to and fro around the globe. But I guess, and, you know, I urge people to read the book. You know, it's, as I say, there's so much more in the book than we might have spent time talking about. But I might leave you with a kind of like quite mean question, which is, so what are you doing next? Obviously, this, you know, the ethnographic practice and writing the book takes an incredibly long time. You know, it's a very different style of research to things that maybe, you know, might be done a little quicker. But there's always the kind of sense of projects that could come from the book. Or are you interested in doing something completely different?
So I have you know, a couple of different projects that I'm you know, developing at a nascent stage. But one of them is looking at economic imagination in state capitalist China. So I still want to work in China and look at you know, aspects of financialization and economic practice in China, but I'm kind of shifting slightly away from working in an organization, and that's partly because of the, you know, there's a huge time investment in terms of doing an ethnography of an organization, not least in getting access. It took me 6 months to get access to Sisteo, and I simply don't have that luxury of that time to do that again. So You may or may not know that China's, in terms of China's stock markets, it's quite unusual and quite different from, from say the UK or the US, in that the majority of investors in the Chinese stock markets are not institutional investors, but retail investors. That is, everyday citizens, ordinary citizens rather, who are investing in the stock market. And what's interesting, in other words, I wouldn't be studying experts. I would be studying non-experts and their economic practices. And I'm very interested in them because, unlike, say, fund managers or pension funds, they typically aren't making kind of evaluations about, a company's future profitability when they buy their shares. Instead, they're speculating on state policies and perhaps state intervention in the stock market. And we saw this in 2015 when there was a big crash. The state intervened, halted trading and IPOs. And so this idea that when people are investing in the stock market, they're actually speculating on the state, I find really tantalizing and really interesting. So I'm hoping to develop an ethnographic project which will look at the practices of investing, and in particular, how do people, with what narratives, do they actually, develop the conviction to invest in such a kind of unpredictable context?
Sounds like a fantastic book project.
I hope so. I hope so. It's going to be many years in the making, and I'm yet to do the fieldwork, but that's certainly going to be the next thing on my agenda.